Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. All right, Mike, exile. You've mentioned this many times, and I think it provides a good single answer for where we are right now. It kind of places us. But I'd be curious, you know, very simply, how do you define exile? What does that mean? And tell me a little bit about how you stumbled onto that.
Yeah, good question, Pat. Well, exile essentially means outsider. So if you're an outside a system, that means you are an exile. Now, the reason we're starting here with this question is Max Dupree. He was the former CEO of Herman Miller Furniture Company in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Max wrote a book called The Art of Leadership, or Leadership is an Art, rather. And he famously said, the first responsibility of a leader is to define reality. I like how Westmont College puts it out in Santa Barbara, California. In fact, I probably like anything that anybody does in Santa Barbara, California. And they said one of their aims for graduates are to be able to locate ourselves in history. So this is a liberal arts college, has a tradition in the Christian faith. And I think that they're right, that they seek to create graduates who, like the sons of Issachar, understand the times. And then in light of that, you know what to do. Otherwise, you can't differentiate between activity and advancement. You could be busy, but you're really not building anything because you don't know where you're starting. It'd be not unlike, Pat, if you were lost in the woods and didn't have a compass. Movement doesn't necessarily mean advancement. You could be moving away from getting to where you need to go to return to safety. So that's why we're starting here, because we are starting with the idea of exile. And exile, again, means outside. And it's drawn from scripture, where the Judeans were actually in periods of exile quite often in their history. In fact, far more than most people imagine. Probably the great epochs in Jewish history would be Egypt, where, again, they were outsiders in Egypt. You also have the Assyrian exile, and then you have the Babylonian exile. And so there are a lot of cultural analysts today who believe that the situation that the Western Christian faith tradition is in, that would pertain very much to the United States, is similar to Babylon in that we are in exile.
Yeah, okay, well said.
I don't know about that, but.
this idea, how did you discover this? When did you first start hearing about it? Is that something that you concluded over time, or that you sort of stumbled into yourself and built upon? What's the origin of that? Rewind us back in time and kind of how you first started to make sense of that.
Yeah, that's good. Well, the quick answer is none of the above. We're simply standing on the shoulders of giants here. For me, I was a church planter. I was actually, before then, worked with a campus ministry. And even then, way back in the 1800s, no, I'm not that. Even then, you know, we did what some of my colleagues up at Yale called cat burglar evangelism. So we had to wait till the lights were off on campus and the guard was down, and we could sneak over the wall and go in and try to snatch a few souls for Jesus. Now, our intentions were great, but it's the idea that when the lights are on and the college was in business, so to say, and classes were operating, We really didn't have any. We were outsiders. We didn't really have anything to contribute. And so I even sensed that when my wife and I were working on the campus at Louisiana State University, and I began to do some training to see if I could speak in classrooms, and actually did. And I really enjoyed that experience, but that experience also brought home that the average student, if they know Christ and want to follow him, they have to go to some sort of Christian activity in the evening and then go on a Christian retreat, then go to a Christian church. But the lion's share of their week, faith disappeared. It was inconsequential. But I felt that also as a church planter, and I used to joke that I could give the opening prayer in the Senate, but I was politely asked to leave when legislators got down to business. And so it was more of an intuition, a feeling, kind of a splinter in my mind that what's wrong with this picture? And I was an undergraduate philosophy and history major. There's a history major I knew and knew to this day. You can visit towns on the East Coast in the United States, but you can certainly travel throughout the world and see how the Christian faith actually helped to put together those towns and cities, and the influence also in the founding of the university, modern medicine, so on and so forth. Yet here I was living, beginning in the 1980s when I first felt this, or the 70s rather, and we weren't building much of anything except for what is often called these subcultural parallel institutions in which Christians operated below the surface. And so that would be, Pat, how I began to stumble upon this feeling that we're outsiders and it doesn't feel right. But that's a feeling that a lot of us share. I call us the new diaspora. We're not really that well connected around the world, but there's a whole bunch of us. They tend to be younger than I am, and they just sense that something is amiss in how we have sort of pulled together in our imagination what the Christian faith is, how it operates, and the sort of impact. In fact, the seminary that I attended, their basic, one of their ruling assumptions was the world will get worse and worse and go to hell in a handbasket. And so our diminishing influence is just one more sign that Jesus is close to coming.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. So I've heard that even among my peers my age that weren't in seminary. I kind of noticed two things. One, when I was growing up, the whole idea of being outsiders was sort of accepted as a norm and as mm-hmm. as a this has always been right as Christians we've always been outside. Having talked to you, I've started to realize that's not always the case. And you just pointed out a couple examples, but could you give just a quick one or two kind of more in depth examples of why this isn't a natural state of being a believer, but this is actually a relatively new thing.
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you asked that question, Pat. I think part of the confusion to give everyone a kind of give them a break is there's a scripture that describes two kinds of exile.
Mm, good, yeah, yeah.
And so the first is just the natural expected outcome of when you come into the kingdom. And you have actually a dual citizenship at that point. Our citizenship is in heaven, the writer of Hebrews points out. So we are, quote, strangers and exiles on the earth. And then Peter reinforces that we are exiles in the world. So first of all, that's not a bad thing. That's just one of those dynamic tensions that we live with. It's a both and. It's not unlike the dynamic tension of Christ is fully man, yet fully God. And if you go, oh, I can't quite figure that out, well, that's part of the point. And we have this dynamic tension that we have a dual citizenship, of which we have a higher responsibility as citizens of the kingdom of heaven, and yet here we are citizens of the planet Earth. And that is what it means to be exiles, because we turned over the dominion of the earth to Lucifer in the fall. And so it doesn't mean we're not to be in the world, but it means that we're not to be of it, because we are exiles. Now, that just, these are all just, that's just a natural condition. The old adage is, you solve problems, you manage conditions. This is a condition that we will manage until the end of time. But there's a second kind of exile. And that kind of exile is not a natural condition. It is an indictment. It's an indictment for idolatry. And so if you read in Jeremiah, in the Babylonian exile, when through the prophet Jeremiah, God says repeatedly, look in Jeremiah 29, for example, you are exiles, I have sent you into exile, you are exiles in land of exile. And that comes after hundreds of years of God warning his people, the Judeans, that you have not loved your neighbor, you have not loved me, you have been insular, you have been wrapped around your lovely temple, and so on and so forth. And then finally, because the nation does not believe it, doesn't believe the judgment is coming, doesn't believe they haven't been that bad, doesn't really buy that they haven't loved their neighbor, God finally grabs them by the nape of their neck. There's three deportations up to Babylon, where they're going to wake up in the morning and smell Babylonian bacon. And he's going to say, you are exiles. So that's the difference there, Pat, is these two types. And the first type I find most believers are familiar with. I don't think I've seen a lot of them work out particularly well, the dynamic tension. That the second kind is more difficult to face, because it's actually God pointing his finger at us and saying, I am judging you for idolatry. So those who have suggested that the Western faith tradition, Christian tradition, is in exile are saying that the Western Christian tradition, the modern one, the 500-year-old one, is idolatrous.
Well, to that point, what would you say is the indictment for us? What is the thing we've been chasing that we are guilty of idolatry?
Yeah, one word, enlightenment, or two words, the enlightenment.
Okay. Unpack that a little bit.
Sure. So the Western tradition actually goes all the way back to Paul's journeys into Europe. And so the Western Christian tradition is one of three great branches of the faith. The faith sort of grew like a clover. And by that, if you can imagine a clover, to the east, the Asian church went all the way to China. To the south was the African church. And to the west, Paul's missionary journeys, for example, went into Europe. And so the European church flourishes, and eventually 50% of the Roman Empire is converted. Now we know that we have eventually the decline and crash of the Holy Roman Empire, and then we have the rise of Islam. With the rise of Islam, the Western, ancient Western Christian tradition hangs by a thread. It's almost entirely wiped out. By the 9th century, it's just a small ghetto. A good little book on this is How the Irish Saved Civilization, because you have in Ireland, you have scribes who are maintaining the great works of Western literature and the scriptures and so on and so forth. So, but with the rise of Islam, you have almost the annihilation of Western Christianity. Now, you say, so what? Well, Islam reintroduces the West to the writings of Greek rationalism. And so as Islam recedes and the West begins to experience a renaissance, that includes Greek rationalism, which will give rise to the Enlightenment. And the enlightenment is essentially that the autonomous individual on their own, by using their mind, can figure things out. Hence, out of that came the modern Western Christian tradition that is primarily marked by individualism, rationalism, pragmatism, all of which we have elevated to such a degree that we unwittingly idolize the individual, the rational mind, and pragmatism, that is being pragmatic. In other words, if it works, it's good. And by the way, the reason that these are called idols, Pat, is an idol is just simply loving something too much. So God created Adam and Eve as individuals. There's nothing wrong with the individual, that he or she are inherently good. But more importantly, God says, let us make them. Our deeper identity is that we are mystically bound and connected to one another, just as God the Father, Son, and Spirit, even though they are three persons, are never referred to as individual persons operating independently. In fact, Jesus said, I never do anything on my own initiative. And so, made in the image of God, individuals are supposed to be bound up in a mystical unity that transcends the individual. When that sort of fades into the background, we go from being individuals to what's called individualism. It's not unlike saying we're social beings. Socialism is the idolatry of those basic ideas. We're communal. Communism is the idolatry of the communal. Individualism is the idolatry of the individual. And so what we have, just like we have a rational mind to some degree, we're supposed to be rational as far as that is God intended us to be and that we can be. Rationalism is the elevation of that, turning it into an idol. And so quick examples would be, most people go to church where they want to go to church, when they want to go to church, as often as they want to go to church. That's individualism. And there's no pastor on earth going to tell me when to go to church. And so we know from surveys, the average evangelical attends church half as much as they self-report. Another aspect of individualism is individuals can self-report on their spiritual state. I am saved. I am growing. I am doing well. God is pleased with me. And without any other voice speaking into their life, either confirming that or challenging it. In the same way, the individual then becomes the final source of authority. Hence, out of the Western tradition, I've lost count. I would have to look it up, but this tradition has spun off and probably at least 50,000 denominations. And that is the famous Disciples of Christ founder Campbell is one who said, no man or history or tradition can tell me how to understand scripture. I simply stand over it and read it, and I know everything about it. That is this enlightenment view that I think, as Descartes put it, therefore I am. And therefore I can determine what scripture says. And out of that came the famous paradigm for how we study the word: observation, interpretation, application. And so without putting your hands on anything, you can know in the entirety what a passage says. And that is the exact opposite of what scripture says, how we gain knowledge. But when you create something as an idol, two things happen. Idols blind you, so that most Western modern Christians have forgotten how knowledge is gained. And then second, it's very hard to knock an idol over, that famous story out of the Old Testament. God would knock it over. In the morning, they wake up, they'd be put back up. We don't like our idols to be knocked over. They give us a sense of security and solidity. And so these two idols, primarily individualism and I am the final authority as to right and wrong, came out of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment came out of primarily a rejection of the church and any sort of authoritarian structures, because of course there were abuses, there was corruption in them, and so the way out was not to reform the institutions, it was to jettison them and elevate the individual who's using their rational faculties can figure out truth and create a better society.
When you're going through the isms there, would you, I imagine several listeners may like have come upon this thought, but would you lump capitalism in there as well?
No, because not all isms are bad. So actually I'm pro-capitalism. So capitalism comes out of the monastic movement, which comes out of the so-called, but not really, dark ages. But in fact, the inception of capitalism comes from, first of all, comes from caput, the Latin for mind, but mind used in the best way that comes even out of ideas that you see in Genesis, where you work 6 days, we work six, and then on the seventh we rest, what's called Sabbath. But Sabbath was supposed to be a celebration of completion and a remembrance. It wasn't supposed to be for abstaining from a celebration. So if you're going to eat, drink, and be merry on the seventh day, you have to have surplus capital from your 6 days' work. So the idea of surplus, capital, accruing, saving, that's all implicit in the creation account. It's really worked out in the beginning of the monastic movement, which became banking centers for capital and the amassing of capital. And then you have, by the 14th century, the word has actually developed capitalism. But again, it's just the idea that private accumulation of goods. Now, I would say it was, according to Adam Smith, it was supposed to be virtuous capitalism. And so, to the point that virtuous capitalism is built on Adam Smith's two books, the second of which you will learn in an MBA school, The Wealth of the Nations, 1776. That title is taken from scripture. But the first book was written in 1759, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which Smith basically, if I were to summarize it, virtuous capitalism requires virtuous people. And virtuous people will understand the amassing of capital and goods is not simply for my own welfare, but for the good of all. Put another way, economic prosperity, as he talks about in The Wealth of the Nations, is for social well-being, or shalom. That's what he talks about in The Theory of Moral Sentiments. You put those together, and you have a good capitalism. Today, as you know, we are primarily dominated by crony capitalism and collusive capitalism. So what we're seeing are corruptions. But no, every word that ends in ism is not necessarily a corruption of something that's good.
Well, let's go back to the university for a second. I think that that's actually a really good example to see sort of where we've come from as a faith tradition and where we are now, and some of the, what I would say is the evidence of that exile. So you had mentioned kind of a recent, in the 70s, 80s account. I was in college, early 2000s. And so I saw that, you know, it is definitely not a religious center, but it really has sort of become this opposition, right, to the faith, where we see this sort of university science, that push, and then we think faith is opposing to that. And yet the origin is not that way at all. So can you talk a little bit about some of the history and why you think that really our faith tradition was actually responsible for the university?
Sure. Well, the modern university, again, also arose out of the same time as the monastic period.
And which is when?
Well, the monastic period begins 5th, 6th centuries, but by the time you get to AD 1000 into 1100, you have the development then of the modern university. And uni, one, versity, diversity. And so if you imagine a wagon wheel spoke, you would have in the center the queen science would be theology. Now, when they're saying queen science, they're meaning, by the way, that's interesting, they call it the queen science. I wonder if that has any implications with the church as the bride of Christ, but yeah, maybe not. I've never thought about that. But science is the Latin word for knowledge. And so what we're talking about is the preeminent, the ordering knowledge, that the centering knowledge that makes sense out of everything else was theology. Now, out of these spokes, you would have biology, finance, economics, just the engineering, what have you. So if you imagine all the spokes in the university, they were supposed to spin off from those, and that formed the circle of knowledge. In a classical, liberal, i.e. broad, arts education, you wouldn't have a major, because you were taught to think broadly, you were taught how to think, not just what to think. I'll give you an example right now. The rage in education is STEM, science, technology, education, mathematics. So graduates today can certainly know how to spin codes up into black swans, or what are they called? The billion-dollar industries. So you can learn internet, you can learn how to monetize the internet, but you can't, you're a pygmy when it comes to trying to make meaning of it. In other words, our social technologies are demonstrably contributing to, not solely responsible, but contributing to social isolation, the dramatic rise in suicide, especially amongst the young. And yet the average person who knows how to work with code doesn't really have any capacity to think about that. They haven't been trained. The reason they haven't been trained is, Pat, you went to the University of Maryland. If you see the physical layout of the University of Maryland, as you well know, each and every discipline is isolated in their own building. So you might go take business and learn spreadsheets, but you'd never read Shakespeare. Because what does Shakespeare have to do with business? And you certainly never read the Bible. What does that have to do with business? And so you learn how to run a business, but you don't necessarily learn how to create a virtuous capitalist society. And so this goes all the way back to, again, first, the Enlightenment, and then second, the rise of the 1800s movement called positivism. And positivism, I dislike, philosophers come up with some of the worst names, but it basically is a positive step forward. And the positive step forward was, we're not going to divide the world between believers and atheists. We're going to divide the world between religious people, believers, and then agnostics. And agnostics simply say, when it comes to matters of faith, we don't know. The search for truth is honorable, but can't really arrive at any conclusions. And so they developed a world where science, technology, education, mathematics, those are built on facts. Religion is built on faith. Science, technology, education, and mathematics are built on propositions, and religion is built on preferences. And so the highest virtue in the realm of preferences, or what Nietzsche called values, the highest virtue is tolerance. Because we're not talking about truth anymore when it comes to religion. We're talking about your personal tastes. So, Pat, we're in a world today that Christians sound like this. We believe that veggie pizza is the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to pizza except through veggie pizza. Because we're talking about a personal taste we have in religion, but there's no, it's not truth. It's true in terms of, well, sure, that's true for you. That's what positivism created, and it's reflected in the layout of, even the physical layout of the Apple campus. And this is the first school that was actually built upon this idea. It was the graduate school at Johns Hopkins University. And so, which has, now the hospital is different, but on the campus there is no chapel, there is no reference to faith. And again, if you're working there as a Christian, you have to do cat burglar evangelism. Now, right next door, where we live, is the United States Naval Academy, and where positivism appears is that on Tuesday nights at 8:30, I think for an hour or an hour and a half, it's called ECA, extracurricular activity, and that's when all the ministries and the rest can all pile on campus and run their Bible studies and what have you. Why? Well, because the classrooms are dark and the professors have gone home and the real learning is done. And now people are getting together to talk about their preference in pizza. Or it could be advanced basket weaving. Or underwater snails that are fascinating to observe.
Speaking from personal experience?
I don't know.
Well,
that's the world we're in.
Yeah. So,
way to go to get it, to get back to where we, I think to return, there is a man I know in his work. He said this is a 100-year project to get the faith back to where it once was in the modern university. It will take 100 years.
So to that point, I guess, so what is coming to mind, right? Mm-hmm. So why even make that effort? What makes you think that a return is even the direction we ought to go some would argue this is just the way that the world was designed to decay, and Jesus will come back and that will be the end?
Well, I agree, Pat. If that's how someone feels, I'm probably not going to change their mind. There's some fascinating neuroscience on the fact that once you're probably past the age of 30, very few people ever make a particularly significant paradigm shift. And then the work of a man named Leon Festinger called Why Prophecy Fails actually demonstrated that if you are a passionate believer, it's even less likely you would ever come to recognize reality, because the ideas you have are not just simply ideas or assumptions. You feel that God gave them to you. And so to any way question them feels like you're questioning God.
Right.
And so our work is really, the reason you and I are having this podcast is that we're on a hunt for what we call the sons of Issachar and the sons of Judah in Babylon. These were people who had a splinter in their mind and just said, you know, I just think somehow we're kidding ourselves. Something ain't right. Something ain't right. And the thing that I hear, the highest compliment perhaps that I've received pretty routinely, is people say, you gave language to what I feel. And so, what can be done? Well, first of all, the whole educational arena is fairly resistant to innovation. And innovation is the idea that we should be constantly returning. Now, back to your point, Pat, you're back to your question. Can we return? Should we return? Remember, the early church was fundamentally Jewish, and the fundamental verb in Judaism is return. Now, that's because here's an important distinction between the ancient tradition and today. The Western faith tradition in Christianity tends to view history as a straight line. So if you can imagine a straight line arrow going left to right, that's very different than the early church, in which the fundamental image was a circle. And in that circle, we're always returning to who we ought to be, and hopefully getting closer and closer. C.S. Lewis said something to this effect, that, you know, we shall be back at that place, but as if we're there for the first time, and we'll come back to it again, and we'll come back to it again. And so the great verb in Judaism is return. It was in the early church. But it's all built not upon a linear view of history, but a circular one, in which, to steal from Lewis Carroll, we go deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole and discover more of the mystery of the kingdom. And in that regard, Pat, I think it not only is possible, I think it's the only way forward. The only way forward, actually, as Lewis wrote in one of his books, C.S. Lewis, is often to go backward. In other words, he said, if you find you're on the wrong path, the wisest move is turn around. Turn around. Return to where you veered off the path and get back on the path. And the path in Scripture really reflects the way that God was imagined all the way up through the Middle Ages. He too is a sphere, Father, Son, Spirit. And only a triune God can be depicted best as a sphere or a circle. If God was only two persons, you could draw a straight line. But God is three, co-equal, sharing one nature, but distinct persons, best depicted by a circle of love. And so when we return to the circle of love, and we return to love, it's actually demonstrable that we can build a better world.
So this I think is a good kind of transition to talk through. If my faith isn't understanding that all have fallen and now need to be saved, the idea of a better world, right, that is to come, and that is the next world, so to speak. And my role here really is to go out and share my faith. If I'm in the workplace and I'm not sharing my faith there and being vocal about it, then I am not doing my role as a Christian. Why is that? Connect the dots between that and what you just said of we can actually kind of love the world and restore this world.
Sure. Well, and you know, I came to faith in that same sort of assumption, Pat, so I'm very familiar with it. And it's what we call, it's necessary but insufficient. So it's a fine and noble ambition that people are lost and we're to share our faith. And by the way, I would say that, you know, I probably have more experience in that than most people I know. Our first year here, as I was a church planter in 1987, we saw over 100 people come to faith. I only know that because I was doing these baptisms, and I was like, what in heaven's name is going on here? And eventually had the University of Maryland, a graduate student, do a study. And in our first 5 years, 60% of our growth was by conversion, which the average church is about 2% at best. And I don't take any credit for that. I just remember thinking it almost felt out of control. And it was just it was about a 5-year season. So, I applaud that. Here's the problem. That view starts in Genesis 3. And in Genesis 3, we fall. So if that's the gospel, then there was no gospel before we fell. Gospel means good news. So the Bible has no good news until we fall. Which...
not really what you want.
Yeah, I'm being careful here. A lightning bolt doesn't come through the window. That's like crazy, man. And it's crazy because the good news has always been that God is love. God the Father, Son, Spirit is love. Love wouldn't exist if God didn't exist. Love always seeks to expand the circle. The gospel is God seeking to wed his love to a bride. Us. And that starts in Genesis 1. In fact, you can't even understand the first couple verses in Genesis 1 if you didn't understand that before the creation of the heavens and the earth, Father, Son, Spirit, angels, a war, all that took place before. In fact, I can't even use the word before, actually, because there was no time, space, history. Genesis is the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And so you had the beginning of a story of creating beings who were designed to be God's bride. Let us make them in our image. He can't expand the circle of love. God cannot expand the circle of love by creating other gods. And you might sit there and go, whoa, are you saying God can't do something? That's right. He can't lie. He can't hate you. God's omnipotent, but that doesn't mean he can do anything. And God, by very definition, cannot create God because God is uncreated. You can create beings like God, and so you can have persons who share some in his nature, and that's the gospel, Pat. The gospel has always been God the Father, Son, Spirit, seeking to wed their joy by having a son wed a bride. So if we had never fallen, there would still be good news, and the good news would be, I'm looking for a bride. You are my betrothed. And so when I come, a great consummation. And so this story was best told in our physical body, particularly in our sexuality as male and female. All of that path exists before the fall. So we actually see the gospel, I'm just saying the historic faith prior to the Enlightenment and prior to this new, shortened, very truncated gospel, this very small gospel, always began with creation as our design. The fall is our default today, but it's not our design. We're bent, but not broken. The image of God is effaced, but it's not erased. It's marred, but it's not mutilated. And God seeks to restore that, redeem that. And since that redemption includes our body and our physical body lives in a physical world, our redemption requires or is enhanced or certainly is enriched by a renewed world. For God so loved the world, he gave his son. And then you have the final consummation or restoration. So, Pat, we've often called that before in the past a four-chapter gospel. And you and I, when I came to faith, same as you, came into what's called this two-chapter fall redemption gospel. So it has enough of the middle guts in it to get you to heaven, to get you into the kingdom. It doesn't have enough gumption for thy kingdom come to the earth.
Spending time just meditating on the Lord's Prayer was something, as growing up as a non-denominational evangelical, was never something that I did, nor was I taught. But man, when you do spend time there, it's pretty incredible. And as you start to realize that the two chapters and the gap, the tremendous gap between that and even something as subtle as the Lord's Prayer, right? A couple verses is pretty eye-opening to see there's something else to this that I haven't seen before. And that was a pretty eye-opening experience for myself.
Oh, I mean, me too. And it's not until we return to the church as the bride of Christ, then we go, oh, no wonder it would start this way. Our Father.
Mm.
What do you mean, our Father? I thought it's my Father, your Father. No, our Father. Why our Father? Well, because we married his Son. Oh. And then Paul writes in his second letter to the Corinthians, I betrothed you to Christ as your husband, that I might present you as a pure virgin. So now we go, Yeah.
I mean, those dots start to fall in place.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, you go, wowie zowie.
Well, and we'll talk more in depth next time, but the 2-chapter verse 4-chapter gospel, again, you talked about creation, fall, redemption, restoration, and how the 2-chapter gospel is just those middle two chunks, right? The fall and redemption. And that idea that if that is your lens, if that's your frame to understand your faith, then it doesn't really make sense why you would be going into work, why you would be sitting in church, why you'd be doing anything if it wasn't for the sake of either saving your own soul or saving someone else's. And as you mentioned, the love of God, if that is meant to be for the world, when you suddenly expand those 2 chapters into the 4 chapters, you start to see, wow, you know, God created this world. He created man even to work in this world, right? How often do we think of Genesis. It's actually really comical. From the 2-chapter gospel, we have our two bookends, right? Genesis and Revelation. So creation and restoration in the 4-chapter gospel. And we look at those two pieces as paradise, right? So what happened in creation? Well, God created this beautiful place for us to sit and do nothing all day and enjoy his creation. And then in restoration, when we're in heaven, we are to sit and do nothing and enjoy God's paradise. But that doesn't really line up with scripture. If you look at creation, Adam was put there to work. Work is not the evil of the fall. Work is actually part of the origin of us, which is fascinating.
Yes, it is. And yes, and the fact that you say it's fascinating is spot on. 25 years ago, roughly, I started a early Friday morning, just open forum conversation for business people. It was a local country club. And the first first time we got together, about 40-some. And I said, take a sheet of paper and give me the best word that describes heaven for you. And then the majority had the same word. And do you know what that word was?
No idea.
Boring.
Oh, wow.
Now, the average Western evangelical church is 61% female. Where are the men? Most of these men, the reason we started this is the wives came to me and said, hey, John won't come to church. And well, what she had never asked and what he never had the courage to tell her is, I don't know why you go to church. It's boring. Some guy prattled on for 30 minutes about something with angels and this and that. And I love my work. I'm working hard at it. We're doing well. And I love playing golf. So to your point, Pat, and this will be, you know, one of our upcoming podcasts, is there's more going on in Genesis than the average person understands, chief of which is we don't even know why we work. And one of the things we'll tease out in the next one is work is when his bride gets up to speed with the groom, who is a worker. And Jesus doesn't want to marry a bride who has no dirt under her fingernails, doesn't have a clue as to how he created the heavens and the earth. Just kind of a, he doesn't want to marry, I'll take a risk here for the listeners who are blonde. He doesn't want to marry a blonde ditz airhead. He just doesn't want to. He wants to marry a bride who, so two become one. That's why Paul wrote, I betrothed you. That's not engagement, by the way. That's marriage. That's marriage, as they say in Princess Bride. It is the pronouncement of marriage. And in the Jewish tradition and in the early church, you would then prepare. That's why Jesus is off preparing a place for us. That's why Joseph, who was the husband of Mary, was off preparing a place for her. Mary was betrothed, that is, married. Come back together in a year, consummate the marriage. This rework, so that we, as Paul said, are a pure virgin prepared for the consummation, the wedding banquet, the wedding night, all of that. And I think the average Christian, and what I just said, goes, huh? So there's far more mystical going on. That's even why, Pat, you correctly noted, you go to Genesis. Adam begins to work. What happens that first day when he works? He names the animals. What happens at the end of the day?
You got me.
No, I don't have you. He goes to bed, and it says he couldn't find a helper suitable. Something's missing. See, we're back to the same thing that happens with people who go, you know, something about our tradition just isn't, I can't put my finger on it. Adam goes to bed, and he can't put his finger on it, but something is missing. Something is missing. He named the animals, dog, cat, parakeet, cockadoodle, da-da-da-da-da. And he goes to bed at night and goes, that was fun, but hey, something's missing here. Goes to sleep. What does God do?
Creates a helper.
That's right. He takes a rib, creates woman. Adam wakes up. He names her too. But he names her with this sort of holy cow, wow. I mean, this thing is like Shazam. And the reason why is, remember, Father, Son, Spirit said, let us make them in our image, male and female. Why? Because no individual on their own can fully reflect the image of God. And the gospel is God marrying us. Adam can do that on his own, but he doesn't know that. Now, in the Enlightenment, if the Enlightenment was right, here's how the God Bible would actually read. It wouldn't tell this fascinating unfolding story. It would be this. Open up chapter one. God, point one. God is three persons. Bullet point under that. Father, next bullet point. Son, next bullet point. Spirit, next bullet point. God is love. Next bullet point. Expansion, enjoyment of one another. Wanting to expand the circle. By the way, pretty fascinating, isn't it, so far? Isn't that fun to read? That's how most sermons now.
Yeah, we should put that in a little packet and hand it out.
Oh, my gosh. So you would have, God would say to Adam at the end of the first night, hey, before we go to bed, let's have a talk. Okay, first of all, we are one, Father, Son, Spirit. Got that, Adam? Second, we're going to marry you. But you can't reflect our image. So we're going to put you to bed, and you're going to wake up, and we're going to make someone for you. How in heaven's name would Adam make any sense out of that? I mean, we think what the Enlightenment has caused us to forget is we're talking about finite beings. We're talking about an infinite God. How much can finite beings know about an infinite God?
Right.
Only what the infinite God chooses to accommodate to tell us, because if he rolled everything out, our brains would explode. They'd be splat on the wall. That would be Adam. And yet the Enlightenment is basically says, here's the human body. It's a brain on a stick. Fill the brain with information. The body carries the brain around. Think right, act right, and everything will work out. That's not what you see. We'll close with this. The neuroscience tells us, by the way, the quicker you explain an experience, the more you sap the excitement out of it. So Adam sees Eve, and we know what happens. It says Adam knew Eve. Now, we'll talk about that our next time on knowledge and how it's gained. This was hands-on exploring, experimenting, excitement. Now, when did God rush in and say, and let me tell you what's going on here. Let me explain what's going on. This is a picture of the gospel. There's no evidence he ever tells them. This is why the Enlightenment is a disaster. Furthermore, Adam and Eve, after they make love, notice that God is love. God is maker. The first thing Adam and Eve do together is make love. They don't sit there in bed afterward and pull out a cigarette and light it up and go, so Adam, how does this apply to our life? That's the fallacy of the Enlightenment. That's why we're in exile. There is a way out, returning to pre-Enlightenment faith traditions.
That's great. I think we can end on that.
I think we can.